Welcome to Studio 2 on a Thursday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. A lot to get to on the show today, Cherry. Our main segment, our middle segment, is going to be about why Philadelphia does not have a WNBA franchise. It's the fourth largest media market. Women's basketball is ascendant right now. So what would it take to get a WNBA team in Philly? Would the city support a WNBA team? We have a trio of guests for that segment. And, of course, we want to hear from all of you. And I am especially curious if you have thoughts about
the name.
Yeah, what would the name be of our hopefully future WNBA team here in Philadelphia? I have a thought.
I have some thoughts as well.
Email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And by the way, Avi and I are very excited about this segment. He and I, we both love women's basketball.
Love hoops.
So we love the hoops. I would go to a game. I would be a supporter of the team, whatever it's called. You will find me there.
And you would wear the swag.
I can't wait.
Reiterated to me over and over and over again that you would wear the swag.
Absolutely.
I think they should be called the Philadelphia Freedom.
Ooh.
As a tribute to the song that Elton John wrote for, it was a tennis team owned by Billie Jean
King.
That's
a good one, though.
Called the, and you know, that kind of takes you back to the 70s and, you know, feminism, women's liberation. I feel like it would be a nice callback.
Yeah. And by the way, thanks to everybody who tuned into our office hours on Instagram. We got a whole list of names. Possibly.
Yeah. Read some of them real quick.
The Bells.
Okay.
The Independents. The Warriors. Love.
The Philadelphia Love.
The Philadelphia Love.
I mean, the Philadelphia Pride was in there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that Pride was in there. Yeah. Some others as well.
Okay. Give us your thoughts.
Yeah. And that's our middle segment. And on our final segment, we're going to be talking about AI and deepfakes.
Yeah, we have an expert from Drexel who is something of a deepfake detective.
Mm-hmm.
He uses technology to help try to sort out which images and videos and audio are authentic and which ones are not. And he's going to talk about that process, but also more generally about how artificial intelligence is supercharging the world of deepfakes right before an election.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting discussion as well. So let's jump in the news. You ready?
Yeah, let's jump in. You start, Cherry.
So, unfortunately, yesterday, a shooting broke out during an Eid celebration in West Philadelphia. Of course, Eid al-Fitr is the celebration that marks the end of Ramadan. That incident left 3 people hurt. 5 people were arrested. Apparently, 2 groups were exchanging fire. 30 shots were fired. That's according to police. Luckily, no one was killed. Here is Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel talking about what happened.
99% of the individuals at this event are good people who wanted to have a good time. And once again, we have young people engaging in gunfire who just really destroyed the same thing what happened.
By the way, that event had about 1,000 people there, Avi, including children, the elderly. One of the officers, police got there extremely fast. They were engaged with one of the shooters who was a 15-year-old male. People said with all that violence, they've never seen anything like this happening at near a masjid, which is or mosque, during a religious celebration. One of the men, the fathers of one of the 15-year-olds who was shot in the stomach, he said that his son was an innocent bystander and that this religious event was supposed to be a safe haven. And now everyone who was there is traumatized.
Such a sobering reminder of the challenges that the city faces, and especially because it seemed like we were headed in a better direction. And hopefully we still are. But, you know, the latest crime statistics show that year-to-date homicides were at a level not seen since 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Really sharp declines in murders and in shootings. And then you have this.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you're always wary of the fact that, you know, this horrible violence can resurface at a moment's notice.
Yeah, and thank goodness no one was killed, but there's a ripple effect to shootings like this. I mean, especially you're relaxed, you're dressed in your festive wear, you're not expecting something like this to happen, and now, you know, your religious celebration, marking the end of Ramadan, right? Fasting, all of this, and then you have to, you know, you're running and trying to hide the children for safety.
It punctures your sense of safety.
For sure.
And your sense of community. We talked briefly there about crime statistics, and I wanted to draw attention to a report released this morning by Pew. This is an annual report called The State of the City, and it looks at how Philadelphia is doing on several different metrics. WHYY's Kenny Cooper has a summary up right now at WHYY.org if you want to check it out. It does mention crime. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, major violent crimes are at a 20-year low in Philadelphia.
Wow.
However, property crimes, retail theft, that is up. When you look at health metrics, the number of folks uninsured is way down. That's a positive trend. However, the opioid epidemic remains a massive hurdle. Looking at the economy, this is interesting. Philadelphia's poverty rate, obviously, still too high. However, it's at its lowest point since the 1990s. Wow. Employment figures are pretty strong relative to where Philadelphia has been. And the median household income is on the rise. If you want to read the report, get the full summary, again, head on over to WHYY.org. But this State of the City report is a great annual gut check to see where Philadelphia is thriving and where it is falling short.
I will tell you this. I would love to be able to stop saying Philadelphia is the poorest of
big
the
city.
Large
yeah.
big cities. Yeah, I just want that to not be something that we always have to say. And I also wanted to point out that the economic growth is not equitable at this point. White, non-Hispanic households out-earn Black and Hispanic households on average by about $40,000 a year. And so there still needs to be a lot of work to make sure we have equity. But overall, this is a positive outlook, I think, on the city. Another thing that I think is positive, people, you know, may have some words, but Sixers great, the one and only Allen Iverson, he will be honored with his very own statue on Friday.
Tomorrow.
The Sixers made this announcement last month, but the unveiling is going to take place on Friday. And I got all kinds of notices about after parties. So
what?
You know it's about
I
to be real.
I wasn't invited to us. What?
It was to my personal email. Anyway, the Sixers retired Iverson's number 3 jersey about 10 years ago. He was a very influential player. You want to go to the party.
I don't go to a lot of parties, and I get that, people.
But you would go to this one.
I wouldn't go. I just want to be invited.
Okay. That's fair. But, you know, I always used to play his response to
the practice thing.
About practice.
Yeah.
What y'all talking about? Practice. I love that. But let me just lay out some achievements of why he deserves this. He won Rookie of the Year in 97, Most Valuable Player Award in 2001, was a Hall of Famer in 2016. He was a 7-time All-Star and named an MVP in 2001 and 2005. And other people on the team who have statues, and I know you love this stuff, Wilt Chamberlain.
Sure.
Julius Irvin,
Dr.
a.k.a.
J.
Dr. J. Moses Malone, Charles Barkley, just to name a few. So it's a pretty big honor.
Yeah, and I would say for Allen Iverson, you named his accolades on the court. He's a much more, well, not much more, I think he's an even more important figure in terms of cultural influence.
You are absolutely
on the
right.
NBA. Mm-hmm. And we can get into that whole backstory another time. But he changed the way NBA players dressed and presented themselves. He was unapologetic. I'm going to go on a quick side note here.
Yeah, go ahead.
The statue will be over at the practice facility in Camden with all the other statues. I'm not saying the Sixers should get an arena in Philadelphia, but if they do, can they at least promise to bring the statues back over the river?
So we can see them.
So the whole point of a statue is that you're bringing your kid into the game and the kid says, Mommy, Daddy, who's that? And you go, oh, that's Allen Iverson. I grew up watching him play. And you create that connection and the generational bonds of sports fanship. Having these statues over in Camden so the employees can see them walking into work has no impact or effect. Let's bring the statues back to Philadelphia.
Are
you with me on this?
I'm with you on that one.
The
yeah.
fans are the ones
the
who
question
should
is
be exposed to the statues.
Will the statues be? Will they be at Wells Fargo? Probably not. Or
I'm just saying, at least
is.
Make that a condition.
Yeah.
If we're going to let you build an arena, at least bring the statues back over
Ooh,
the river. At the very least, right?
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Is yeah. that too much of an opinion?
I don't think that's too much of an opinion, especially because we're going to be talking about the WNBA today and we have strong feelings.
We do have strong
about
feelings.
That. But that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing, having the statues
just
in
bring
Philly.
The statues back
yeah.
over, please. here's an opinion. expressed by Leslie Knope on the show Parks and Recreation, as played by Amy Poehler, about what she thinks the cutest animal
is. Wonder what that is.
Scientifically, hummingbirds are the world's cutest animals. I mean, they're so small, and they have tiny beaks, and they only eat sugar water. I mean, what beats that? Come on, baby monkeys in diapers? Yeah, they do. Baby monkeys in diapers are the cutest.
Well, this story is about hummingbirds, not baby monkeys in diapers. Hummingbird migration has started, and there's a crowdsourcing science project called Hummingbird Central, where you can say where you saw a hummingbird in our region. So apparently they've already been spotted in Cape May and Lansdale and Cherry Hill and Medford. Again, this is hummingbirdcentral.com. You can help us identify where the migrating hummingbirds are humming in our region as they pass through.
And, you know, this article that I read to prepare today learned a lot about hummingbirds. You know, their wings beat up to 80 times per second. They're like flip, they're going so fast. Yeah. And their hearts beat 1,200 times a minute. These little things, they are cute, though. And then and if you want to, you know, help the hummingbirds out, you can put out a feeder that has red color so you can see them from a distance. And that we can make, you know, nectar for them. Four parts water, one part sugar.
Four parts water, one part sugar. And I put that in a feeder.
Yeah.
And that helps the hummingbirds.
That helps because that's what they eat, sugar water.
It is really, really adorably cute.
They are adorbs.
Are they cuter than baby monkeys in diapers? I mean, that's really one of the great philosophical questions of our time.
I don't really find baby monkeys to be cute, but that's on me. You know, some people may disagree. I love the yucking of the yum that they said earlier this week. So, you know, for some people, if they love that, that's cool. But I would say the hummingbirds are adorable.
Allen Iverson was sort of like the hummingbird of the NBA. They were sort of smaller, but really active and fast. And sort of played bigger than his size.
Yeah.
So let's just tie it all back together.
I love it.
And then transition to a basketball segment.
Yes, which we are looking forward to.
Women's basketball. Cherry.
We both love women's basketball.
We love women's. We were captivated by the NCAA women's tournament this year, as was much of America. Record ratings.
Yes. More than the men's, by the way.
More than the men's. So will that translate to success for the WNBA, the Pro League? And could Philadelphia get in on the fun? Could we support a WNBA franchise? We are the fourth largest media market, according to Nielsen, the Nielsen definition. The bigger three all have teams. Is it time for Philly? Get your opinions in studio2@whyy.org. That conversation is coming up. I'll hold you in my loving arms, but I'll let you fly free. Hummingbird. Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We all know that Philly is a big sports city. I mean, think about it. We have the Eagles, the Flyers, the Union, the Sixers. But one thing, one team is missing. Philly does not have a WNBA team.
Crazy.
Or
maybe it's not. We're going to dive into that today. We are one of the largest cities without a pro women's team on the basketball side. So what is the holdup? The question is what we're asking today to our guests and our listeners. Should Philly have a WNBA franchise? Would fans support it? And what would it take to get it off the ground? Weighing in on all of that are our guests today. Renee Washington, host of PHLY Sports and a former professional soccer player. Renee, welcome.
Thank you guys so much for having me. Pleasure being here.
We're also talking with David Berry, who studies sports economics at Southern Utah University. David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And of course, listeners, are you clamoring for a team? Do you think the fans would support it? And what do you think we would call our team? We should call our team. Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
David, I want to start with you because we've got a ton of comments already. Yes, let's do it. Aaron says, we're the only big city without one. This is overdue. Erica says, I think it would help so much in so many areas, especially with mentoring young girls in sports. Tons of enthusiasm, David. But before we really get to the Philly specifics here, what is the economic state of the WNBA. I know at one point it had more teams. Now it has 12 teams. It seems like there's some growth, but measured growth. I mean, where is the WNBA positioned right now? I think roughly 27 years after its inception.
The WNBA is right where you'd expect the league to be after 27 years. So if you compare it to the NBA after 27 years, which is roughly the NBA in the early 1970s, the WNBA is doing extremely well. Revenue per team right now is actually higher than revenue per team was adjusted for inflation, was for the NBA at the same point in time. WNBA revenue has doubled in the last 5 years during the pandemic. It went from $100 million for the league to $200 million. So it's doing extremely well for a league of this age. It generally takes 4 or 5 decades for a professional sports league to look like we are accustomed the NFL, NHL, NBA, Major League Baseball to look like. It is not something that happens in the first 10 years. All of those leagues in their first 2 or 3 decades looked a lot like the WNBA right now.
Wow. Quick follow-up to you, David. I mean, a couple of years ago, the WNBA announced that it would expand the league, adding 2 teams. One was in San Francisco, was selected. Portland was selected. Portland kind of dropped out. Philly had originally been on the short list. What would it take for a team, like for Philadelphia? Walk us through the steps to get a team.
Well, this is the problem. So the NBA at this point in time, they expanded from 8 teams in its 20th year to about 17 teams in like 10 years after that. So there's a rapid expansion. But they had the American Basketball Association, a rival league that existed at the same time, pushing them to expand. The WNBA doesn't have that same rival league pushing them to expand this time. The WNBA will only expand, and this is an important thing for people to understand. The NBA owns half the WNBA, and one of the CEOs of a WNBA team put that ownership arrangement this way for me. They said, if the WNBA owners, all 12 of them, said, we want to expand, we want more teams, let's do this, and the NBA says, that's not going to happen, then it's not going to happen. Oh, the wow. NBA controls this. They decide what's going to happen. And what they've done is decided that they don't want to expand rapidly, which I think is a mistake. I think they should be trying to get into as many markets as possible. They should recognize that the WNBA is a growing league. This is a huge economic opportunity. If I asked you right now, if I said, let's go back in time. It's 1972. Do you want to buy the Philadelphia 76ers? Would you buy that team right now in 72? You'd say, absolutely. It's going to be worth billions in 50 years. That's where the WNBA is right now.
Okay, can I just narrow in a little bit, though, more, David, now on the Philly part of this? How would Philly potentially get to the front of the expansion line whenever expansion does happen? Is it just about having some investors who want to do it? Is it something about the market or the demographics that the WNBA is looking for when it talks about expansion? Like, what are the ingredients you need to get to the front of that expansion line?
Yeah, I'd love to be able to tell you the answer to that, but the WNBA doesn't really tell you what they're looking at. The WNBA has this habit of saying, you know, we're totally looking at expansion. We really want to do this. And then nothing kind of happens. And so they don't really tell us what's the magical thing that they're looking at that makes them want to do these kind of things. It is the case, and this is something that I've written about, is that it is the case that when it comes to investment in women's sports, the investors tend to treat women's sports as if they are buying a taco stand. They're looking at profits and costs and revenues on a monthly basis to see if it's a good business. Mm. When men invest in men's sports, they look at it as, I'm really excited about this, and I don't really care if I make money or not. I just want to be involved. And so that's one of the issues, is that you have to find investors who are enthusiastic and are willing to stay there and understand if you stick with this for a few decades, you're sitting on a gold mine. But you have to be enthusiastic enough about it to do that.
And so, Renee, I want to bring you into the conversation. And first, reading some more, we have you know, Janice's comments, what people really supported, and not just when the team is winning. Other people say Philly needs a professional sports women's team ASAP. My family and I would be season ticket holders. So you heard, you know, there's some mixed reviews in there. You heard what David had to say about the way a lot of the NBA and the men owners view women's sports, your reaction to that, and then we'll piggyback that and talk about what you think about bringing a WNBA team to Philly.
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate to work with the WNBA in 2022 and got a lot of insight that people don't realize is going on behind the scenes. And as David was alluding to, at that time, going into season 25, now we're going into season 28, the WNBA is not operating as its own league. It is completely under the umbrella of the NBA, even down to the internal employees. So as a media member, for example, I was one of the few, I could count on a handful, that solely just worked in the WNBA. They even still had the majority of their social media team, their media coverage, their website, that was outsourced through the NBA as employees doing both. So it's not even just about the expansion team-wise, it's the expansion of the league as a whole has not been in a place to operate on its own. A lot is heavily reliant on the NBA. So in terms of growth, to see in 2025, we're going to have two new teams. Of course, we know, as you mentioned, the Bay Area, not sure it's a question mark since Portland pulled out of that other expansion city, that there's a need, there's growth, and that's why we've seen Athletes Unlimited launch for women's basketball, women's sports. That's why we've seen more happening outside of the WNBA, trying to expedite what's happening in the WNBA to showcase. There is a need. There are players that are all-stars, MVPs, first-round draft picks that do not actually end up being able to even stay in the league because there's not enough teams and roster spaces. So it's a bigger conversation. Philly's a huge part of that, but there's a need to keep this talent in the league.
Let me ask you about this juxtaposition between the WNBA and women's college basketball. Obviously, the WNBA is growing, but we're not seeing ratings like we saw for this latest women's tournament. How do you explain that, Renee? You were a great college athlete yourself. Why does it seem like there's a bit more interest now in the college game than the pro game?
So to have the peak around 24 million viewers for the Iowa South Carolina game is incredible.
It's
fantastic to see. I will say, though, it's not new. We've always had this big gap, but I know I just saw recently it was the anniversary of when Candace Parker was drafted 16 years ago. I remember even back then,
right?
Even back then, I remember everybody was watching Tennessee basketball. Everybody's watching, you know, Stanford, Tennessee, the top programs, but it doesn't translate into the WNBA. And I think it's because people just paid attention during March Madness versus the entire season. And so if there's a way to connect and bridge that gap, that's how you can get those almost casual March Madness fans to translate over. I see it in soccer. People pay attention to the World Cup. People pay attention to She Believes Cup for soccer. They don't pay attention to the NWSL the entire season. So I think what's the beauty of today's age, social media, NIL, it allows these players to get their names, their faces. You connect with Caitlin Clark, you connect with Angel Reese, Camila Cardoso, and now you want to follow them into the league. And a lot of people are saying, don't stop. You've had 24 million viewers. Let's continue that viewership. Continue following your favorite players into the league the same way you do on the other side with the Zach Edes and the college basketball players that are going into the NBA.
And we're talking because the WNBA has its draft coming up. You kind of touched on the point of, you know, there are not very many roster spots. Talk about this. Caitlin Clark, everybody's been talking about her. Angel Reese, they both declared they are available to be drafted to the WNBA. What would expansion mean for the league, bringing in more of these top star college players? Talk about that and how it could benefit as we all look to Monday.
Exactly. I mean, the draft being less than a week away is exciting, and it's also nerve-wracking because, unfortunately, and I remember this part of the process as well in being involved in the league, there for every Caitlin Clark that comes into the league, there's another player that's unfortunately going to be on the outs. You don't see that in the NBA. You see guys traditionally, as they get drafted, they're expected to have 5-10 years. That's not the case for the WNBA because there's just not enough spots. Yeah. And so I think for cities like Philly that are in the conversation, Nashville, Toronto, there's various cities that have been involved. It's so imperative to showcase, as you guys touched on, not only can we house a team here. We had the Philadelphia Rage, the Philadelphia Fox decades ago. House a team, but keep a team here. You're going to have the fans. You're going to have people wanting to go to games because we see it at the collegiate level. It'll carry over into the WNBA if you provide the teams, if you provide the opportunity. So it's exciting for these young players. You know, you look across Cameron Brink and Camila Cardoso and Angel and Caitlin, but it's also a reality of, for every player drafted, unfortunately, when you have about a dozen players per roster and 12 teams, that's not a lot of players in the league.
No, just 144 spots. It's an elite club.
It is.
We did have some folks chime in on what they think the name should be. And I'll start. Well, I'll read this comment from Allison, who said, "Now is a good time for a team. Bring Dawn Staley home to be the coach." Well, she'd be giving up a lot of money.
I know. The Gamecocks have her locked down.
But Ed and Geraldine emailed that the team maybe could be called the Philadelphia Dawn.
Actually, it's not bad.
Christopher says the Philadelphia Bells. So keep sending in those suggestions. I want to bring David back into the conversation. David Berry, you study sports economics. I guess I look at this a couple ways. One, Philadelphia, hugely passionate sports market. On the other hand, we do have WNBA teams in markets like New York and Chicago that are also sports crazy. They're drawing about 7,000 fans a game. Is that an okay number to sustain a team? Do if we brought in a team to Philly, would we need to try to grow on that attendance number for like an average game?
That is exactly what the NBA was drawing when it was about 25 years old. And if you go back to when the NBA was about 10 years old, it was drawing about 3,000 to 4,000 fans a game. This is the reality of how professional sports work. And you can see it when you look back on the history of the NFL and the NBA, Major League Baseball. In the NFL, which is the biggest sports league in the world right now, there were 44 initial franchises, 90% of them went out of business. So 40 of them completely folded in the 1920s and 1930s. It was a similar story in the NBA. It was a similar story in Major League Baseball. The problem in all those sports, and especially in football and basketball, there was a college sports that was going on that attracted lots of fans. College football was very popular going back to the 19th century. The problem is you can't simply take those players, stick them in a professional setting and expect the fans to just follow, because the fans are emotionally attached to the teams.
Right. Live in Ohio, you really love Ohio State, that type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So you're going to see the fans have an emotional attachment to Team USA. They have an emotional attachment to South Carolina. But when you stick those same players on the Washington Mystics, the fans are like, I don't know what a Mystic is. I don't know what that is. Is there a history there? When the Mystics play the Lynx, is that a rivalry game? We take for granted when you watch the NBA that Lakers Celtics mean something.
Right.
It didn't mean anything in 1955. Nobody knew what that meant. And so you have to be patient. The WNBA will be there at the same spot, but you're going to have to wait probably another decade or so before it looks a lot like what the NBA looks like right now, because you got to let those fan bases develop.
Yeah.
And it just takes time for that to happen.
I want to bring in Esther Rosen. She is a WNBA franchise advocate who runs the account on X called WNBA Philly. Esther, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you so much.
So from seeing your post, I can tell you're a big fan of women's basketball. Why did you feel so strongly as a fan that, you know, you needed to start this account and advocate for the WNBA to bring a Philly team? Why did you do it?
Well, so I actually grew up a Sixers fan because I'm from the area. And I actually love women's sports on that account in particular, because I make it a point to never talk about men's basketball on that account, because it's really important to have a women's space in this area, I think. And it's becoming clearer that in a lot of aspects, women in sports is women being allowed access to the institutions that have been created by and for men. And I was hunting around online one day, I think it was after the Aces won the championship in 2021, and I was like, there's got to be somebody who's trying to get a team here, because I know Philadelphia and I know basketball and we really like basketball. And it turned out no one was doing it, and so I just decided that even if I'm not the best person to do it, I am a person to do it.
I like that attitude. I do.
And somebody better can do it better one day. But for now, no one else is doing it. So here I am.
What's the reaction been to your account? And by the way, if you want to follow, it's at WNBA Philly. Esther, what has the reaction been?
It's been really fun, actually. I've made a lot of interesting connections and like had some good conversations with people in media and people who are just like random Philly folk. One person is a elementary school teacher, and he was like, can I send you, I assigned my students persuasive essays about why Philadelphia should have a WNBA team.
I love that.
And I was like, yes, please. So it's been overwhelmingly positive. Every now and then I get like some person in the comments that are like, women are good at basketball. And I'm
trolls.
Like, okay,
yeah.
take that elsewhere. Cause I don't really like that. It's not even worth the conversation at this juncture. Like there are separate entities and we need to respect that they're separate entities. So.
Well, I will be following you, Esther. Thank you so much. That's Esther Rosen. She's a WNBA franchise advocate who runs the X account at WNBA Philly. Make sure you follow her. And I want to bring you back into the conversation, Renee. I mean, you heard that. Fans out here loving it. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation about many of the WNBA teams being owned by the NBA. Who do you think should own? And I want to just sort of tee this up by asking this question because Crossing Broad's Kevin Kincaid spoke to Sixers co-owner David Adelman, asked him whether or not their ownership team would launch a WNBA team. Adelman said, quote, they didn't want to sign a second lease with the Wells Fargo. That was one reason. Also, he said, we feel strongly that the NBA also feels strongly that the controlling owner of a WNBA team should not be an NBA owner. I want you to respond to that. Who could and should be an owner of a WNBA team?
Ooh, whoever has the financial backing to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Listen, as David even talked about, to have a franchise and have the stability is really tough in professional leagues. We see in the NHL right now, the Coyotes just announced their relocation. We see it in baseball. The Oakland A's are relocating. It's hard to keep a franchise. And a great example, to be honest, you talk ownership, you talk as we even had a chance to hear more about WNBA Philly. The Philadelphia Union launched. It was the Sons of Benz. It was an organization of local advocates that wanted to bring a Philly team to the MLS.
Grassroots.
That was back. It was grassroots. That's how it starts. I'm in the process, ironically, as we're having this conversation, of trying to bring women's soccer to Philly. It starts on the grassroots level, but then it takes that investor that's got the financial backing that can now bring in, you know, what you need to actually sustain it and make it happen. So for Philly, whoever, Allen Iverson, make it happen. I know you guys are talking about him earlier.
Now.
Listen, the statue's there.
Yeah.
You're talking about him. Maybe it's time for him to really take that next step and be able to help bring women's basketball. Dawn Staley would be a great person to be involved with it. I think it just has to be a combination of personalities, a combination of former players. In the NWSL, you see NFL players. You see, you know, basketball players. You see all different types of investors. It doesn't have to just be basketball, to be honest. It just has to be somebody that's an advocate and respect and values women's sports coming into the city.
With a long-term vision, too.
Bingo.
I think you really need a long-term vision.
So how much money, though, David? How much does it take to launch a team? Like, who are these people? Who do we need to talk to? How much money? What does that pot of money
It's not
going to
be
like?
You and me. I know that.
But you need the media.
Okay.
You need to have a home. You need all of that.
It is amazingly cheap, okay?
Oh.
Major League Soccer team in Charlotte, the investment was $325 million to start a team. I'm sorry, Major League Soccer is minor league soccer. The major leagues are in Europe. I don't
Ooh,
personally, as a sports economist,
drop
see
bombs.
That Major League Soccer is going to become, it's not going to become the English Premier League.
Uh-huh.
So investing $325 million in a minor league sport is a bad idea. WNBA is a major league sport. This is I have a book coming out next month called Slaying the Trolls that talks about all of these things. It is the case that women's sports, WNBA, National Women's Soccer League, those are the major league sports. Those are the sports that in decades are going to be worth billions. So what's really odd to me as an economist is that you have people who are buying these franchises. And right now, the latest figure is that these top franchises are selling for like $100 million or one-third the price of a Major League Soccer team.
So WNBA is around $100 million per?
Yes.
Okay.
So as a sports investment, that's a bargain. That's a huge bargain. If you can buy a franchise that's going to be worth billions right now for $100 million, That is a huge, huge investment to be making. So really, you just have to find an investor who understands the nature of how sports economics works. And so, I don't know, send rich people in Philadelphia the book that's coming out next month and have them read it. I don't know what else to tell you.
Good
I mean,
plug.
That's the way to do it.
Good plug. All right, I'm going to read one more email and get one more question into Renee. Tracy says, we can support the WNBA by highlighting high school ball down south. They celebrate high school teams, girls and boys. When was the last time you covered girls' high school teams? Talking to us, I guess. Do you even know how many girls' high school basketball teams we have in the city? We don't celebrate our girls here in the city. Quickly, Renee, just a minute left. Do you see that changing, sort of from that ground up, that idea that girls' sports, women's sports has real support here in Philadelphia? At the beginning levels, is that changing?
I started out in high school sports in the area, and I could say there's such a great excitement around girls and boys high school sports, and it's phenomenal to see. I think there are a lot of local writers, a lot of local networks that cover it, and I just feel like, unfortunately, where it gets missed is, much like we talk about the transition from college to pro, from high school to college, let's continue following them. You know, yeah. What are they doing in college? What's their career like after high school? There's so much talent in our very own backyard, and I do think if everybody can continue, let's not just complain about it on social media. Let's actively uplift and encourage and make it happen, because women's sports are growing and it's time to bring a team to Philly. And I think this is the step in the right direction for that to happen.
And we're having the conversation. Let's do this.
That was Renee Washington, host at PHLY Sports. Renee, thanks so much for the time. You also heard from David Berry, professor of economics at Southern Utah University. He mentioned he has that book coming out called Slaying the Trolls. David, thanks for your time.
All right, coming up next on Studio 2, how to detect a deep fake. They're popping up. We're going to be talking about it after this. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Misinformation has been a big problem in recent elections. False stories about candidates, voting, the election itself, all that spreading rapidly across social media. This election cycle, though, it's not just fake news that experts worry about. It's fake pictures, videos, audio. AI-generated deepfakes, as they're often called, look so real, they're almost impossible to detect.
But that's where our guest, Matthew Stamm, comes in. He's sort of a deepfake detective, closely examining an image or a video for the evidence that they've been altered. Remember last year when the DeSantis campaign doctored a picture of former President Trump hugging Dr. Fauci? Well, it was Stamm's lab that verified that it was a fake. Matthew joins us in our studio to talk about the challenges of detecting deepfakes and how to defend against them. Matthew, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you much. Excuse me. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Matthew, I want to start here. Let's imagine a scenario. You get a video.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through the steps that you would take to determine whether it's authentic or not.
Yeah, so one of the challenges right now is there's not really a well-established process.
Mm.
And it also changes depending on whether you have an image or a video or audio. If we were to see a video, most of the ways that videos are manipulated nowadays, or at least that people seem to be concerned about, are what we call deepfakes, right? Where this is technology that grabs the face from one person and splices it onto another person using a bunch of different AI-based techniques. If we want to look at that video, we'll use some particular detection algorithms that we've made in our lab or in other labs. What these do is they look for invisible traces, just visually imperceptible traces that are left in fake content by whatever created them or edited them. So the way you can think about it is, if someone were to break into your house and try to steal your TV, they touch things. They leave behind fingerprints or hair, other trace evidence. If you make a deep fake, if you capture an image or a video with a camera, the camera, the AI generator, Photoshop, whatever you're using to change it, it leaves behind different forms of trace evidence.
It leaves behind evidence.
Yes.
Explain that more. What type of evidence?
So it's kind of hard to describe without getting into too many mathematical details. But I guess the way you can think about it, apologize if I get a little technical.
No, I'm asking you to. Yeah, go ahead.
Is when you make an image, it's kind of easier to think about for images. When you make an image, it's a bunch of pixel values, just kind of recording of the light color values at each spatial location. The way that you do this induces certain relationships between pixel values that are nearby one another. The way your camera works, the lens, the sensor, and all the processing that's going on inside.
They're like part of a set, almost?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of things. Yeah, it's kind of this chain of processing, both physical and algorithmic. A lot of times algorithmic has an even bigger influence, kind of depending on what you're looking for. These induce relationships between different pixel values that are very different than what happens if you AI generate something, if you Photoshop something. If we're looking for a deep fake, we'll look for inconsistencies between the face and what's going on around. Or we also maybe build a model of what's happening in your face. But this is different than some stuff that's happened very recently. So we've seen text-to-image generators, things like Midjourney, things like that. Very recently, we've seen Stable Diffusion and OpenAI release text-to-video generators. Probably the most well-known one right now is Sora, released by OpenAI, though I don't believe that's publicly available, though you can see some pretty amazing videos. There's not guaranteed to be a face. There you need to look for traces that say, hey, this came from an AI generator and not from a camera.
And so give us some clues. Like, so I'm a regular person, and I'm thinking about the whole controversy about Princess Kate's photo. You know, there were little clues and people said, oh, this is manipulated, this is fake. Are there clues to that you can see from your naked eye to tell whether or not something is real or not?
So there can be clues, but one of the problems is the clues depend on the way that you've manipulated the media. Mm-hmm. And if it's an AI-based approach, they kind of tend to change over time. Mm-hmm. If it's images, I think images still have a hard time with specular reflections, like the little dots of light in your eyes,
in the eye,
right?
Okay.
A real image, you have a common light source. They're going to be in around the same place. AI generators don't necessarily make them in the same place. So you can say, hey, there's no way a real light source would do that. A lot of times you see weird hair textures, an extra finger, things like that.
I've seen that, yes.
In the past, so for like the images of Donald Trump and Anthony Fauci that were used in the DeSantis campaign ad, there one of the big tells was they had a White House seal in the back of the press room, and it had a bunch of letters, but it was really incoherent text. At that point in time, these AI synthesis techniques couldn't make consistent words, but they can now, especially as they've been integrated with large language models. And I think this really shows that if you're looking for a visual tell, they may go away as we get better and better at making visually realistic media.
What types of signatures will remain, though, or will any of these signatures remain? Like 2-3 years from now, will even the analysis you're talking about with pixels, will that be helpful?
So that will remain pretty consistent, or at least these traces will occur unless somebody's making a really intentional effort to make them not show up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to make something visually realistic, or in the case of audio, just like audibly realistic, your main emphasis is on that, not trying to like wipe away these traces.
Yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm.
you can make an intentional attacks. But that's not what companies like OpenAI and Stable Diffusion are trying to do. They're trying to make perceptually realistic media. So right now, I mean, I'm a little biased. This is what my lab studies. But those traces seem to be persistent.
Yeah.
They've been there since we started studying this field, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. They seem to be there. We just have to continually look for new ones as new ways of creating, editing, manipulating media are show up.
I want to talk about information warfare a little bit, like because it sounds like an element of a conspiracy theory, but it's actually a thing. So talk about how people can use deep fakes to influence and some of the trouble that it can cause.
Yeah. So deepfakes, I should also mention, the word deepfakes is another thing that kind of evolves. When it first showed up, it was these videos where we're swapping someone's face with someone else. But now the word kind of has expanded to mean a bunch of different things. So there's audio deepfakes, where you're cloning someone's voice, or just text-to-speech, which are two different ways of making this. We've started to talk about images as deepfakes when you have AI-generated images. Within my technical community, we tend to call those synthetic images, but they're more broadly being known as deepfakes. And it's kind of remains to be seen what word we're going to use about these text to video things that might get lumped in with deepfakes. They're being used for a wide variety of malicious purposes. So we've seen evidence of them in political misinformation. We've seen evidence of them in perpetrating fraud and financial crimes. So my memory's escaping me, but I believe there have been multiple incidences of where someone's tried to clone a CFO's voice, call up a company and say, hey, we need to make, I need you to move money into this account.
Make a deposit here.
We're going to rapidly acquire this company. And then once the money is moved over, it's just vanished. I think the first one, I think it was in England, but I could be incorrect, where it was a couple $100,000. But then there was another one, I think it was a Japanese firm in the United Arab Emirates, and that was on the order of tens of millions of dollars.
Wow.
And then the last, another sector that we're seeing it show up is actual hot warfare. So when Russia invaded Ukraine, they did the things that you'd normally do when you invade a country. They took out the SATCOM, the power, internet, things like that, tried to take out the airports. But they also released a deepfake of President Zelensky saying, we've been overrun by the Russian army. Throw down your arms. I don't want to have further loss of life. So we're seeing this used as not just criminal behavior, or attempts at political misinformation, but just as a tool of modern warfare.
Speaking of Eastern Europe, you know, you could go all the way back to, and probably further than this, but you go back to Stalin, right? And Stalin would take his enemies out of old photos to make it seem like they were not, you know, part of the Politburo or whatever the heck it was. And so this concept of fakery being used for political aims is not new. Do you think, though, that this is especially threatening compared to the old sort of airbrush methods, or is it on the same order of threat?
So the way I think about it is largely, in many cases, it's not a new threat, but it's just a big amping up of the scale. If we look at the way we consumed information in the past or the way we got information, most of the time, I mean, when I grew up, you saw information from a major market newspaper, from your radio, from a couple TV stations.
Gatekeepers,
yeah. Right? And they had to try to do a good job of vetting this information because their reputation was on the line. And since then, everyone has a cell phone with a camera on it. Anybody can make images, manipulate images, or video or audio, easily distribute it throughout the world without gatekeepers like social media. So that's good for communication. But now, just ways before of making fake media, you can make it and distribute it at scale in a way that we never could before.
And as we get ready to wrap up, Matt, got to ask you, I mean, are there ways to protect yourself? What should regulators be thinking about? Because, you know, this, how do we deal with this?
Yeah, so I think regulators starting to look at this is a good idea, but I don't think that's going to protect us. Same with putting in external watermarks to kind of make cues that this is fake. There's a number of ways to remove them, get around them, or even potentially put in fake ones. What we need to do when we're consuming information is try to be smart, educated information consumers. If you see something that elicits like a strong reaction, you should try to go look for another source of information, spread it out, and see if you see consistency.
Corroborate. Exactly. That is Matthew Stamm, Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Drexel, where he also leads the Multimedia and Information Security Lab. Really appreciate the time and the wisdom.
Thank you so much.
Before we get out of here,
yeah,
can I just mention, Reed called and left a voicemail for us and says that we should have public ownership of a Philly WNBA team. All the citizens invest and own the team, kind of like the Green Bay Packers.
That would be really cool.
It's an interesting idea.
I know. So many names, possibly. Yeah. We would all chime in on that. So there you go.
And Candia wanted to chime in on hummingbirds and said, don't use red dye or mixes with red dye. Don't use powdered sugar or honey. And thoroughly clean the feeder often. That's according to Candy. Thanks. Lots of comments today.
Very engaged. And that wraps up our show for this week. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered the show. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you next week.